interpreted by the churches, has reconciled the alleged needs of the community as a whole with the individual rights of persons suspected of terrorist offences within that community by ensuring a proper balance, not an idiotic spurious balance of liberty and security, a proper balance between the state's obligation to protect under Article 2 and the guarantee of due process which exists in order to ensure that you get the right people and that you do so in a fair way. So that is, to me, a story, frankly, because levels of political violence in Europe are at an historic low. Certainly, it does not compare with the levels of political violence that occurred during the Second World War, when there was a massive amount of political violence, the purpose of which was to communicate political messages to civilians, involving incomparable and indiscriminate killings of civilians. There is nothing like the level of political violence that there was during the Hanover period, when countries were breaking free of European Germany by the use of vicious violence and were inspiring and provoking vicious violence in return. There is nothing to the level of political violence in Britain, in Spain, elsewhere, Italy, Germany, in the 1970s and 1980s. In this country, within the living memory of most people here, the IRA blew up the British cabinet. The IRA launched a mortar attack on Anderson, which the head of MI5 then called, I remember, cowardly and indiscriminate. Now, there's one thing that parking a van in Whitehall, taking out a mortar attack, aiming it down the street and letting it off is not, is cowardly and indiscriminate. And it struck me that one has to take the language deployed by security persons with a degree of care, perhaps relevant to the last of today's top story of the world. Of course, what happened is that we decided to make a big deal about terrorism. In particular, the most common country in our world, in our sphere, and probably in the world as a whole, has decided to wage what it calls a war on terror. So they've driven this agenda, and they combined it with an aggressive military action abroad, which has meant that as a quid pro quo for opposing the wild excesses of militarism, European countries have felt the need to collude in the fantasy world of the war on terror. So they feel they can't take on both at the same time. Beyond the no illusions, I said this parenthetically, that the elimination of Donald Rumsfeld will make a difference. The issue in the United States of America is about the failure of the invasion of Iraq. It's not about the war on terror. And if you had a look at the kinds of people who've been elected to represent the Democratic Party in Congress, you will not see in them people who are prepared to question these particular perspectives. So the war on terror is not about to end anytime soon. When you read in the United Kingdom about the MI5 judgment about the nature of the threat, you see it's not about to end anytime soon here. And we've got the Center for Social Humanities on a British social survey, an extensive opinion poll, which will be published in January, about the extent to which British people are prepared to face civil liberties in the context of the threat of terrorism, and it makes scary reading. I'll mention too that the European Union has found itself not involved in the terrorism thing, and in a time when it's very difficult to achieve much at European Union level, it's tempting to push ahead on the so-called war on terror. So there's a dynamic within the EU which is disturbing in pointing in the direction of activity. There is also, I have to say, a disturbing possibility that the UN will be exercised to do more in this field. The UN, of course, certified that the environment by Mr. Bolton and Mr. Bush, is showing through its website and its activities that it used to not in its enthusiasm for the war on terror. So there are a series of international, regional, and national dynamics which mean that terrorism has been transformed into this pivotal challenge. And what can a pivotal challenge do? Well, I think it is a pivotal challenge to the whole underlying subject that we're gathered here to discuss today, human rights in general, human rights in particular, and that one of the main battlegrounds for this conflict is going to be the European Court of Human Rights. And I want that to be the main thrust of the remarks I'm going to make. But I want to begin and end in a slightly different vein by saying there's a huge challenge to the Council of Europe as well. And there's a huge challenge to the British Council. So I'm going to talk initially and briefly about the Council of Europe, and then I'm going to talk about the European Court of Human Rights in an indirect way, and then I'm going to talk very briefly at the end about the impact on the challenge of the UK judges. Because we'll see what human rights is made of in the course of the next 3 to 5 years. So let's talk first Council of Europe, then European Court of Human Rights, then British Human Rights. Preliminary remark, the victory of rights talk has always been very fragile. And it's been in conflict with utilitarianism in various different shapes and sizes. And its current shape, essentially, is a national security-oriented shape. The national security-oriented shape produces the so-called war on terror. That's well known. What we also need to notice is that certain intellectuals in the human rights community have joined the war on terror and have redefined human rights as the values of the West, and then feel that it's necessary to engage in some evil in order to fight the evil of terrorism, and that actually human rights as an idea, being a set of values rather than individual rights, can legitimize, in the name of the lesser evil, great harm. And I just remark on that to show how the language of human rights can itself be infiltrated from within and destroyed in the name of a battle of civilizations or a war on terror. Now, the challenge for the Council of Europe is, in my view, fourfold. One, and it flows from the remark I've just made, the temptation to dilute standards. One of the themes of what I'm going to be speaking about this morning is the dilution of standards. And this is the first example. And the best example would be the notion that coercive interrogation is okay, but torture isn't. Or the redefinition of torture in a way which produces some narrow, life-threatening medical imposition, and the rest not being torture, is some other death. And this is one of the different so-called human rights experts have been keen on. That is a real challenge there, not just for the Council of Europe, but for the judges, in restating unequivocally that inhuman and degrading treatment is cruelty and humiliation of a type that renders the whole human rights project undermined if it's permitted. In my view, secondly, apart from dilution standards, the second challenge for the Council of Europe and its judges lies in the development of the notion of a memoranda of understanding. This is in the context of desires on the part of European governments to expel non-nationals to countries where it is, if not probable, then at least possible on the basis of past records, they will be killed or tortured. This is a version of the utilitarian response to the rights analysis. The country needs them out of terrorism. Now, because we as a culture are not yet ready to say that, we are tempted to accept certain figures that allow us to say that they are protected. And the latest version is the so-called Memorandum of Understanding with countries which have past records of torture and to which we are about to send persons unwillingly on the ground that we don't want them in our country. And we say of those countries that the memorandum that they have signed with us saying they promise not to torture and other stuff possibly is sufficient. Well, we need to remind ourselves that the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, who says diplomatic assurances whereby the seeking stage comes not to torture specific individuals if returned, are definitely not the answer to the dilemma of extradition or deportation to a country where torture has been practiced. Such pledges are not credible, and have also turned out to be ineffective in well-documented cases. In short, the principle of non-reforma should not be undermined by convenient, non-binding promises of such kind. That is Thomas Hammer. Now, we need to be alive to that, so that Shulamite doesn't just become a little bit of a counselor. That's actually the counselor position, and it seems to me we must be very careful before we allow nation states and our outlaw members of the counselor to benefit from membership whilst exporting persons from the jurisdiction on the basis of convenient memoranda of understanding. That's a challenge for the Council of Europe. Does it take rights seriously? Thirdly, directly with the judge here, the real challenge to the European Court of Human Rights to resist strong governmental pressure, not just in the United Kingdom, to ditch the Chahal principle and, in the case of Ramsey versus the Netherlands, to redefine the convention in a way which reduces the obligation on states to bear in mind the impact on third parties of expulsion from the European state. There is, those who watch the newspapers know, quite a degree of pressure being piled on by government. Again, it's part of the utilitarian distrust of rights. Essentially saying, you know, the Saudi is excessive, the Chahal case is peculiar, certainly out of date, maybe with the Attorney General of the United States, it's quaint, and the European Court of Human Rights has an opportunity to provide some powerful resistance of why human rights is different from national utility calculations. And if countries feel it is not, they should withdraw from the Council of Europe as still sovereign nations, but they should not expect to have the benefits of the model of human rights underpinning their alleged legitimacy with the desire to do what they will, regardless of the nature of the violations that flow from their conduct. And that takes me to the fourth, and it might be the most biggest challenge to the Council of Europe, because it may well come up, which is the problem of what to do with member states, if any, are proved to have colluded in what is euphemistically called extraordinary rendition. In fact, according to Human Rights Watch, this is state-sponsored abduction and the delivering people to be interrogated and tortured in third countries. The word extraordinary has with it a kind of atmosphere of the massacre. Well, there's nothing magical about being picked up off the streets of Italy, to take a relevant example, sent to a country which has a police state in and then tortured. What if it can be shown, and as we are aware, there is a Council of Europe report, or the European Parliament report on this, what if it's shown and established that member states actually consciously colluded in the delivery of persons for the purposes of torture, either by facilitating the transit through the country, by providing fuel, etc., noise, etc. Then I think there really is a serious question about what should be done. Because I think one of the risks is that the double standards that people have always said are implicit in the human rights story, actually destroy the subject. Double standards, in some of them not so bad, because of the points of paper and some standards in a situation of great tension. But if we are presenting ourselves in Europe, the Council of Europe, the European Union, as a human rights respecting space in the globe, in contrast to other places, and we have persuaded ourselves that our project depends on legality and human rights, how can we continue to regard that as a credible description of ourselves if we are assisting other countries in the torturing of persons by facilitating their movement through our state? So the question is whether or not actually a country that's found has done it should be kicked out of our European organization.
quite a large number of organizations, which not the university, but I focused on this, an organization that dedicates itself to certain values needs to expel people in order to stand for those values. Otherwise, the values are empty. I'm sort of in favor of vocational consciousness raising expulsion. And it could be that that would be a test for the Council of Europe. Anyway, that's the first part of the approach. The main part is about the European Court of Human Rights. I've mentioned already what I think is a challenge to them, which is the how to manage the ransom case. I think it's going to be a challenge to them about memorandum of understanding that ever gets to the court. So there's some challenges already. But this one is a particular one. And I want to get to it via circuitous route because it's the main part of my talk today. And I want to talk a little bit about the United Nations and the European Union. And then I want to talk about a case decided in the Administrative Court in the United Kingdom, in England and Wales, in September of this year. And via the European Court of Justice, I'll eventually get to the European Court of Human Rights. So bear with me. It can take a little bit of time to get to the European Court of Human Rights. But when you arrive there, the challenge will, I think, I hope, be clear. The story starts with reflecting with you on the obligations of UN membership. Now this, for reasons I've explained at the moment, is not used to be a concern, but has become. Article 24 of the Charter, the Member States confer on the Security Council primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security, and agreed in carrying out its duties on this responsibility, the Security Council acts on their behalf. Article 25 then says, members of the UN agree to accept and carry out the decision of the Security Council in accordance with the present charter. Article 41, the Security Council may decide what members not involved in the use of armed force are to be employed in effectuating the decision, and it may call upon the members of the United Nations to apply such measures. These may include complete or partial interruption of economic relations, and grave sea, air, coastal, radio, and other forms of communication, and the settlement of diplomatic relations. So get a picture in your mind of a very strong capacity to act. And then, in case we can get it, Article 48.2, decisions of the Security Council shall be carried out by the members of the United Nations directly, and through their action in appropriate international agencies of which they are members. So a partly potentially intrusive international organization. And then remember, secondly, the European Union. Article 307 of the EC Treaty. Precedence is given as a matter of principle to quote the rights and obligations arising from agreements concluded before the entry into force of this treaty. They shall not be affected by the provisions of this treaty. So UN obligations incurred by all the countries prior to the entry into the European Union, apart from Germany, which I can't remember how, will be immune from European Union sweep. And then the European Union goes on and say, quote, in one of the cases, since Article 307 would not achieve its purpose if it did not imply a duty on the part of the institutions of the community not to impede the performance of the obligations of member states which stand from a prior agreement, the EU then continues and says it legislates in order to implement the various resolutions and so on that arise out of the UN's power in the Charter. Well, this hasn't been a problem because the UN is committed to the rule of law, promotion of fundamental human rights. Very unlikely it would destroy democracy, destroy the rule of law. Well, that's still largely true, but this is where the counterterrorism bill comes in, because it is the violence in the international system. It's becoming an engine for UN action. Well, why would that matter? Well, let's take it through. The stuff that, as we mentioned now, comes out of a particular set of UN resolutions related to Afghanistan, the Taliban, and Islam bin Laden. And let's work out how it impacts on human rights and go from that to the British case, the European Court of Justice, and then, of course, human rights. Well, the story is really well known. Even before 11th September 2001, the protection afforded to Osama bin Laden had made that country a target of Article 41 action. So it was stopped long before 11th September 2001. That resolution 1267 in 1999. And what they'd done was they'd set up the Security Council, that is, the committee, made up of members of the Security Council, the so-called Sanctions Committee. And it actually monitors the sanctions that that resolution puts in place. So there are lots of other resolutions, 1333 in 2000, where they actually begin to maintain a list of individuals and entities which are designated by the Sanctions Committee as associated with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Now, after 11 September, this of course expands. Resolution 1390, 1452. Meanwhile, the EU is enthusiastically acting on the UN side. Regulation 237, 2000. Freedom of funds. Regulation 467, 2001. Prohibiting export of stuff to Afghanistan, and a list stuff comes in as well, specific measures against named persons. Now, there are hundreds of these cases. So it's because of that. So you have a picture of UN Security Council resolutions beginning to impact on actual people through EU regulation, through national action. So it's early days that this stuff is beginning to be litigated. And what we've got is the case decided in September 2006, N and M versus Her Majesty's Treasury and others. The claimants were a housewife responsible for raising several children, this is the main thing, and the person who qualified for various benefits. Child tax credit, income support, disability living allowance, carers allowance, the spectrum of social security in the UK. And there were two of them, I think. But they were each a wife of or lived with a person who was listed on the Security Council regime and who was therefore denied funds. So the Treasury here, acting under the 1946 Act, I'll mention that later, as a domestic law, had arranged a system where our claimants had to be licensed before they could get the money. And the license was to ensure that none of the money found its way into the coffers of the people on the terrorist list. Now, these things challenge that. And because it's a domestic court, and nobody's particularly keen to do a reference to the European Court of Justice, they are saying the EU regulation is ambiguous, and we should interpret it in a way which is compatible with human rights, following the tradition of EU law, general principles of human rights and the European Convention. Now, the ambiguity we don't find is it is very wide, the regulation. It's not restricted to economic benefits in cash terms. It has a potential reach which is actually extremely limited. And so we have to go further than this law, we should be able to interpret in a way which brings it down to make it compatible with human rights. The human rights points were a tweak. Essentially, you are messing up our rights and property. You have done so in a way which is absolutely flouting due process. We're not given a chance to talk about being on the list. We're not given a chance to represent before we're done. We're not allowed to represent to get office. And we're messing up our life prison. Why is my family being destroyed, theoretically, if the license were denied and so on, merely because of some alleged list which includes this guy who's allegedly a terrorist. Now, the judge is a very interesting and good judgment by a man called Kenneth Barker, good in the technical sense, definitely a high court judge. He finds no ambiguity, either as regards language or intention. Sorry, it is straightforward. I'll say not like it, it's straightforward. And therefore, no room for any common law or legal-based presumption of compatibility with human rights. So it doesn't actually get to the point where it needs to reduce it. That's interesting, but this is the bit that matters. He says, anyway, I don't mean that common law provision applies to these regulations. Quote, he seriously doubts
that the common law principle or provisions of the ECHR could have any application at all in the present context. Now, most of you know that EU law, we know why he said that, because cases have just been decided in the Court of First Instance at the European Court of Justice. Two cases involving challenges to the Afghan sanctions regime, they were decided previously. The second chamber sitting with extended conversation. Now, I don't know my EU law very well, so there might be some people on the floor pretending when these cases were going to EU law, whether they have been agreed on only so. This is what they said. They involve the use of case in the Cali case. This is the European judge. I'm swinging out of end into the European judge. Because this is what Ken Parker, this is what he relied on. And this is a quote, longish quote, but it's a sort of penultimate sentence of the any of the European Court of Justice. Any review of the internal lawfulness of the contested regulation, especially having regard to the provisions or general principles of community law related to the protection of fundamental rights, would imply that the court is to consider indirectly the lawfulness of those regulations. In that hypothetical situation, in fact, the origin of the illegality alleged by the applicant would have to be sought not in the adoption of the contested regulation, but in the resolution of the Security Council which imposed the sanction. The court's getting a bit nervous. If the court were to resolve these contested regulations, as the applicants claim it should, although the regulations seem to be imposed by international law, on the ground that the action breaches their fundamental rights, which are protected by the community legal order, such a government would indirectly mean that the resolutions of the Security Council concern themselves infringe these fundamental rights. In other words, the applicant asked the court to declare by implication that the provision of international law issue infringes the fundamental rights of individuals as protected by the community legal order. That's what the individual wants in these two cases. Very similar to Ant, EU regulations messing up their lives, they go to the side of the border first instance and say, this should be annulled, it breaches our human rights, that involves the UN, and the judges say they have no authority to call in question, even indirectly, the lawfulness of UN resolutions in light of company of community law. This is not ours, they say. We're not interested. And then there's a caveat, the second of the mealy-mouthed redefinitions, the language of human rights, there's a caveat to something called just cogens, when in doubt, use Latin. And just cogens is the fallback position of where the breach of human rights is so monstrous that it actually engages customary international law and not mere convention. And therefore, for example, obviously, deprivation of property would be a breach of just cogens, but sensible, organized, rational, planned deprivation of property would not. And so, of course, in both cases, goes on to say, basically, nothing to do with us. And Kenneth Parker, QC, in the end case to which I referred, is looking at this, and that's why he says, well, even if this thing were ambiguous, and even if I referred it to Luxembourg, they're not interested. And moreover, he says, obviously, dicta uses the word Latin, the just cutting is not infringed here. Why? The definition of property is not arbitrary. There's a mountain, there's no procedural fairness, but that's not part of just cogens, and the fairness is a thing, wow, it's not just cogens. So you've got these different levels of human rights, and that's the way we're going to, it's just parenthetically, that's where we're going to destroy the language of human rights. We're going to actually create an alleged extreme set of breaches that we really do bargain against, and the rest is going to be diminished by comparison. Now, this might be just about manageable if it were only about specific international incidents like, for example, the terrible Taliban or Obama. For, of course, we know that the UN is now getting more into the terrorism stuff. And since 11 September 2001, terrorism has broken free of its specific context as the virus of terror among ourselves and turns it into a kind of general law of evil. So what we have, Resolution 1373 is the best known one, 28th September, what we have is a counter-terrorism committee that monitors implementation by states of various resolutions. We have the counter-terrorism committee executive direction. We have these various bonds now whose job it is to hatch up schemes to fight terrorism and then to make sure the nations do what they're told, and that would include the EU. So there's a bureaucracy of enforcement, which is not now specific to places, but is actually more general. And of course, we've seen that in the Southern Covenant of the International Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism, which had a few signatures before 11th September and has lost now, and we see it in the pressure that's been brought to bear to get the UN to sign up to a new convention on the definition on international terrorism. This is a plan which they all want to have a new convention on terrorism, which is not specific to any country and not specific to any industry. So no longer just the Taliban or Osama, no longer just aircraft hijacking of King Hessian state, terrorism. And it's been held off in a very promise because certain countries still eccentrically, amazingly, say you should be able to resort to violence very occasionally if there's a situation of imperialism or if you have a situation of racist apartheid rule. Now this is regarded as an eccentric position in the modern world, that anybody who would be in favour of political violence in any context is regarded as evidence of deplorable aggressive terrorist instincts. But actually, the definition is also very famous. Now we don't have the time, but you know, it's just the usual thing that terrorism definitions always do. They start with death, mayhem, appalling, world destruction, and then we get down to paragraph C2A, it's damage to places likely to result in major economic loss. And you know, so it's all the same. If you don't reach the end, you think it's covering a blue call terrorism. If you reach the end, you see it covers things like successful direct action and successful assertion of civil liberties by extension. Slightly controversial, maybe I'm overstating it. Now, if that goes true, and we have UN resolutions to implement it, we have a situation where we're going to have all these UN bodies that have now forgotten their foundation of commitment to democracy, the rule of law, and human rights, which are actually putting pressure on the member states to implement these various resolutions. And where is the legal safeguard? When it comes to the EU, it's not available because the Court of First Instance, subject to whatever it's called, appeal or rehearing, in other words, is the EU, people can tell me, have said enough. Now, this is where the European Court of Human Rights. This is a big challenge. This is the biggest challenge of all. Because the EU has its own terrorist agenda and has it implementing the UN terrorist agenda. And so the EU is, despite not having a legal act on any of this in the 60s and 70s and 80s, only a serious terrorist about what power absolutely can do. A lot of it's cooperation, judges believe that's all fine. But there's a tendency to the creation of these lists again. And the taking of property and various activities like that. And I think when you get to the making of unaccountable lists of names for verses, which we have in the UN and increasingly at EU level, you have to decide by functionaries under types of review which have no legal dimension, because they're from this pillar or that pillar. You all know the ins and outs. And we got very close to a very, very dangerous situation. And of course, the EU simply reaches into domestic law, so the nations don't even have to implement by law the UN resolution type. It actually can be in the form of a regulation and it's automatic, and if it's in the form of a framework of decision, it has the kind of obligation that attend the direction, it has to be implemented. And there are reports on how well countries can behave in regards to the framework directive of 13 June 2002. What countries can find, though, is if they are implementing the European Union regulation, framework directive, the old European Court of Human Rights is still there. And they can actually say, well, it's the nation that's doing this work, and the nation is obliged to respect my fundamental human rights, and I'm also transport. And so we can use the fact that the EU is using national authorities to execute its anti-terrorism stuff as a way of locating review in European Court of Human Rights. Now, of course, you know, and you're going to be told a lot more than I know about the case this afternoon by Catherine Costello, that now there's a case, and I want to end this section near the end of my talk with some references to the very, very important case of Boston. And this is a case, you'll be told a lot more about it. Basically, these guys got an airplane, they made a mistake sending it to Ireland, and bad enough because it's leaked. Under some regulations, there was nothing to do with who was the federal authority was that. And so they had to lose for 4 years, but it was 3 years, and they landed in some sort of shelter. Not, do not touch. And they don't do very well financially, and there's no compensation. So they are done, but it's under a new regulation. So they take the thing to the judge's colleagues and his son. And so the issue is, as to whether or not there is a breach of the convention rights of the corporate entity that would be applicable to this case. And then he tries to abolish corporations relying upon human rights, use this case to tell them how naive that might be. So the company finds the European Court of Human Rights anxious about this. On the one hand, they have the European Convention of Human Rights. On the other hand, this actually took place because of the European Union, and this is the conflict they're trying to avoid since each of them got going in a bit. And this is what they come up with. They come up with the solution that you have to look for equivalence in safeguards. And this is effectively quote by Flagler. And then you look at it on a case by case basis. This is what they say about it. In the court view, state action taken in compliance with EU legal obligations is justified as long as the relevant organisation is considered to protect fundamental human rights. As long as the relevant organisation is considered to protect fundamental human rights. In a manner which can be considered at least equivalent. So they look across the EU and they say, how good is it at protecting human rights? And they say, is it equivalent to the wonderful protection we get here? And they say, by equivalent we mean comparable. Not identical. Comparable. And so, any such finding of equivalence would not be final, but it would mean with a kind of presumption that it was okay. And that presumption would be rebutted by manifest deficiency, our third measly downgrading of the language of human rights. So if it's an equivalent organization, then we only overturn the decision if the protection of human rights is manifest deficient. So deficient protection of human rights would be okay if not manifest. You know the word manifest is doing there, it's giving green light to abuse, that's what they're for. It's not deficient, it's manifest deficient. So my lord, you know, my taking the taking of my time property. And the state of that time study was merely deficient in human rights. But anyway, the court then reviewed the history of the EU, talked about the way in which the EU Court of Justice developed fundamental human rights, waxed lyrical about all these banana cases, that in fact have been reconfigured as human rights cases, and said, there you are, what's the worst fine? Equivalent. Now, Bosworth was decided on the 30th of June 2005. The cases I've been referring to, which drove the decision of Copper in N, were decided 3 months later, on the 21st of September 2005. So the European Court of Justice in Boston, sorry, looking for human rights in Boston, had available to it the traditional EU version of rights. They didn't have old block by the way, where Security Council resolutions are involved. We opted out. So, challenge for the future. We argued, Bosnia, on the basis, if sustained, that the European Court of Justice does not provide equivalent protection where there is implementation of UN resolutions that engage immigrants. I'm going to be very interested to see how they would say that it does if the European Court of Justice continues with the line that is only grounds of breaches of human rights, just subjects that will warrant our oversight. And then, as logic follows, they need to ask about the UN. They need to say, is there an equivalent protection for human rights in the UN system? And that would take it into the protection of human rights at the UN level, with the various commissioners who talk about human rights, the various committees and so on, and they need to make a tricky call as to whether there is. Because they're going to have before them, if it's the right case, a situation where somebody's probably popped on the list, and they can't get off the list, and they don't know how to work on the list, and by then it might be the winding up of the political party, or it might be the confiscation of property without compensation, or it might be some other even more draconian now. So we'll see. The challenge, in particular the second part, the third is very brief, the challenge for the European Court of Human Rights, must say so, is human rights going to become an hierarchical subject in a new way? Not the old hierarchies we learned about, sort of absolute qualified knowledge, but actually re-designate human rights as having pure, really important human rights. And the rest of it is sort of ordinary human rights. And where it's not a breach of just tokens, or it's not torture, or it's not manifestly deficient, it's somehow or other okay. Because after all, we have the war on terrorism, and we have the need to act, etc., etc. Before you know it, we could continue to maintain that we're deeply committed to human rights, and yet we could be facilitating worse interrogation, we could be facilitating the implementation of appallingly regressive UN and EU laws with no tradition of accountability, and we could be saying still that we are a human rights respecting society, with a European Court of Human Rights, and European Court of Justice committed to general principles of human rights, and so on and so forth. So that's what the future of us under the ball right before. The human rights language won't be removed, it will be colonized by the power. So that leads to the very final part, which is about the human rights act. Because what's interesting about the case of M, which has been the sort of narrative of this talk, is that the judge there never ever dealt with the domestic court. Mr. Brown of the Treasury had not implemented the EU regulation. He had used powers under the UN Act of 1946, which gave him a discretionary power to act to implement UN resolutions. So it was a sort of slightly mild Eurosceptic point of speech. We're not natives of Europe, we're a true Swedish. We can demonstrate it again by the British, who incidentally taking exactly the same view as the Americans and the Iraq war now. Obviously, they won't see the truth in the area. More perfect. But the argument could be made. The Section 3 of the Human Rights Act requires a principle of interpretation, which does not have any exceptions, which is that where it is really possible, statute must interpret what is compatible with convention rights. Section 6, to which there are no exceptions that are relevant, says it is the duty of every public authority to act in a way which is consistent with convention rights. There is no part of the Human Rights Act that says exceptions for the United Nations. Now, there are, of course, ways in which welfare laws could leave it in. You could say there's something where there's no option, but there is an option in the matter of course to accept. It's not mandated. It is not shall implement the decisions of the Security Council. It is may implement the decisions. Now, it may be said that that may is the equivalent of shall, and in which case there will be declarations of incompatibility under Section 6.2 to protect the executive officer. Well, that's the challenge of the British. Are they going to buy into that? Or are they actually going to say sovereignty is a serious matter and human rights is a serious matter? And we are a human rights respecting country and we call it as it is and let the politicians pick up the political pieces. Thank you very much.